The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When Donald Trump accuses the intelligence community of being politicized, that strikes me as a preemptive strike to undermine the credibility of the report, right? So he is actually, in a sense, politicizing the intelligence community by saying, by talking about them in these terms, by talking about intelligence as though it's a partisan talking point. The reasons for doing that might be because this is uncomfortable, right? He thinks that it sort of casts a pall over his inauguration and his election. So sort of a preemptive strike to undercut the intelligence assessment that's unfriendly to him, that's incredibly short-sighted. He's going to need to rely on the intelligence community in the future. And so sort of taking a shot at their credibility now strikes me as a little bit foolish. It's also important to understand that when Donald Trump says the intelligence community is quote-unquote politicized, that's another way of saying the intelligence community is lying.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast. January 7th, 2017, the Senate Armed Services Committee met this week for a political witch hunt, as Donald Trump called it. It was a bipartisan show of confidence in the U.S. intelligence community and its conclusions that the Russians were behind the hack of the DNC and John Podesta. We brought on two superbly qualified guests to discuss the goings-on. Matt Tate is a former hacker for GCHQ and a cybersecurity expert in London. Susan Hennessy is Lawfare's managing editor and a spooky former NSA lawyer. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 203, Susan Hennessy and Matt Tate on a political witch hunt. So let's start with the basic dispute between the president-elect and the intelligence community. Matt, the president-elect says he's skeptical of Russian involvement in the hack. The intelligence community says that it's confident of it. From where you sit, how does the evidence stack up on this side, granted that we don't have access to the classified material?
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot of public evidence that's out there for this particular operation that happened, and much more than I think is usual for hacks of this type. You know, when we look at things like the OPM breach, we don't have as much information in the public domain that was China as we do that this most recent one was Russia. So when people say, you know, that there's not a big case here, I mean, that there really is, you know, probably 100 pages of technical evidence in the event that you're technical enough and really want to go through it. So you can take the intelligence agency and CrowdStrike at their word, but we really don't need to in this case.
Okay, so without going through 100 pages of technical evidence, how would you summarize that evidence? As in, if you were sitting in front of a congressional committee like the heads of the intelligence community were yesterday, and you know, a Trump sympathetic senator said to you, "What's the evidence?" How would you? What is the evidence?
Well, I think there's two big pieces of evidence that probably dwarf the rest of it. I mean, there's hundreds of little pieces of evidence, but two pieces that really sort of stand out from the crowd. And the first is that there was a series of different hacks. One of the hacks was the hack of the DNC network itself. And this cybersecurity company, CrowdStrike, went into the DNC network and they were able to recover some of the malware from this network. And this malware has conspicuous similarities to lots of malware that we know a group called APT28. This is a group that industry has been tracking for at least a decade, that the intelligence community has been tracking for at least two decades. We've been following this group a lot, and so we're able to say, you know, this malware, really, it does look like it's from this group. But more importantly, not only is the malware technically very similar, it was actually driven by control servers that we also know about, because it's the same malware control servers that were used to attack the German Bundestag, the German parliament in 2015. And that was, several other people pointed out at the time that that was Russia. So basically, we're able to say, you know, this is a group that it's not just a disaffected teenager. This is a big organization that did the malware on the DNC network. And then there's the second case as well, which is the spear phishing email sent to John Podesta, who's Hillary Clinton's campaign manager. And this was a little bit different. So initially, this was a little bit difficult to tie into the same group because it happened outside of the DNC network. There wasn't any malware for us to analyze. There wasn't any control servers that were sort of immediately obvious. But the problem was that this group, they screwed up again. What happened was they sent John Podesta a spear phishing email, which is an email that pretends to be from Google. And it says, hey, someone's using your password. You need to change your password. And there's a really interesting story in the New York Times behind what then happened within the campaign that led to John Podesta accidentally entering his password. But, you know, the long story short there is he entered this password onto the hacker's site and the hackers were able to download all of his emails. And that spear phishing email we knew about before the John Podesta emails came out. We've been tracking this group for a long time. When WikiLeaks dumped all of John Podesta's emails, it actually included that spear phishing email, so we can actually just look on WikiLeaks and we can see it. And the problem was here that the hackers screwed up. They were using a URL contraction service called Bitly. And users of Twitter know these URL shortening services that were originally used for keeping your tweets short when URLs are very long. But basically, the hackers were not just sending John Podesta spear phishing emails. They were sending lots of people spear phishing emails. And so they wanted to do this programmatically. They wanted to not have to go to Bitly and do this manually each time. And so in order to do that, they had to use the programming interface of Bitly, which is called the programming API. And for whatever reason, Bitly says, if you want to use our programming API, you have to set up a user account. And so the hackers set up a user account. Obviously, you know, they thought that this was anonymous. They didn't, you know, say that this was Russian intelligence. But the problem is they used the same user account for all of their different spear phishing emails. And a consequence of this is that when they constructed their account, it defaults to being public, and they didn't set it to private mode. And what this means is that we can take some of these spear phishing links, like the one that John Podesta had, and we can go to Bitly and we can say, hey, Bitly, who is the user that created this link? And it will say, you know, it's this user. And then we can go to Bitly and we can say, hey, Bitly, what are the other links that this user has created? And it says, oh, here's, you know, 10,000 links that it's created. And, you know, since 2015. And the links in question happen to include a lot of detail. They happen to include the email addresses and the usernames of the various people that this group were after. So we know that they targeted about, you know, 1,800 accounts or so since the beginning of 2015. And we know who those accounts are. So we can, you know, move on to the next question, which is, well, who are these guys? And it turns out that a very large percentage of them are in the United States. You know, this group is very interested in NATO. They're very interested in Ukraine, especially the political and the military situation in Ukraine. They're interested in the United Nations. They're interested in Chinese companies dealing in Russia. They're interested in investigators of the MH17 plane that was shot down in Ukraine. So, I mean, this is a really prolific group that's self-evidently not an individual.
Okay, so wait, let me just stop you there for a second. Is it self-evidently not a 14-year-old?
Yes. So,
I mean, is it self-evidently not a 400-pound guy on a bed somewhere?
Yeah, so it's just not possible because, you know, even the most prolific 14-year-old hacker, you know, they might be able to get, you know, one or two good targets. You know, it's plausible that, you know, a 14-year-old might have been able to spearfish John Podesta. The problem is that we know that this particular spearfishing email wasn't from a 14-year-old hacker because there's no way that a 14-year-old hacker is able to, you know, be systematically targeting, you know, this is about 7 or 8 emails a day across a very large number of different languages in groups that are of very particular interest to the Russian government, you know, things like MH17 investigators, things like, you know, Chinese businessmen who are doing business in Ukraine, I mean, rather in Russia. You know, this is not sort of the business of, you know, a disaffected teenager in America, right?
Okay. So, Susan, when this is the evidence, as Matt summarizes, that's public, we all have this sense that, and certainly Director Clapper yesterday made clear that there was a lot of material that they couldn't talk about at this stage that was non-public, that is informing a very high confidence level conclusion on their parts. You know, when you look at when the intelligence community chief says he has very high confidence of something, as Director Clapper did yesterday, what does that mean? What I mean, that's a sort of term of art that kind of means something.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think one thing that's getting sort of lost in the back and forth with Trump is what exactly the intelligence community has said thus far and how that should be received. So one, yes, this term high confidence, while to sort of the layperson it might sound like, well, that means you're not sure, that is the strongest terms the intelligence community ever uses. Right? It essentially means we're positive. And I think if you go back to, you know, I mean, Matt laid out kind of the public evidence for this, which is already, you know, rather overwhelming. Whenever you look at that report that ODNI and DHS co-authored back in October, not just attributing this activity to Russia, but actually to the high levels of the Russian government. And you look at the specificity and the carefulness of the language they're using. I think people really need to understand how those statements are prepared and how carefully scrutinized every single word is. These go through interagency processes. Dozens of lawyers read them. Dozens of analysts read them. I mean, it's sort of the ultimate cover your ass exercise of, you know, making sure that their every single word can be backed up and documented. And so whenever you see, I mean, really, it's an astounding document in terms of the level of specificity and for somebody who can understand how much goes into backing up and citing every single line.
Okay, so pause and, you know, what specifically in it jumps out at you as notable for its specificity that makes you astounded, to use your words?
Right. So one, the attribution, the involvement of high level Russian actors, right? High level government actors directing this activity. So that means that they aren't, their intelligence assessments is not just based on what they're seeing in the United States, right? Based on the evidence that Matt described, there's no way the intelligence community would, based off of that body of evidence, say there's a clear indication and there's high confidence of high level Russian governmental involvement. The only way they would come to that kind of assessment is if they had primary source evidence of actual high-level officials in the Russian government directing this activity.
What is that? Is that signals intelligence? Is it, you know, Vladimir Putin's best friends talking? You know, what's the universe of possible stuff that could drive that kind of specific motive discussion of the involvement of high-level leaders.
Right. So it's probably multiple sources. Certainly there might be human intelligence sources, right? So people who have firsthand knowledge of the activities of the Russian government reporting out. Signals intercepts, signals intelligence. So intercepting phone calls, intercepting emails, right? Actual officials themselves describing their activities. And then, of course, there's the possibility that the United States has is sitting on the computers themselves, right? And are, as Matt noted, the United States government has been interested in these groups for a very, very long time. They have lots of knowledge and insight into how these operations work. And so they're the sort of the world from which they might collect evidence is rather large. And I just think it's hard to overstate sort of how remarkable putting that into the public is, because it's revealing it's tipping the U.S. government's hand, saying, hey, we have insight into this.
So not a 14-year-old?
I think not a 14-year-old.
Not a 400-pound guy on a bed?
Maybe a 400-pound guy on a bed in Moscow, subject to the direction of high-level governmental officials.
Okay. So Matt, talk to us about APT-28. We heard a lot about, you mentioned APT-28 in your comments. It came up a few times in yesterday's hearing. What is APT-28, and how did it get such a cool set of initials?
Okay, so APT stands for Advanced Persistent Threat. And basically what happens here is that incident responders, often they discover an intrusion. And what they want to do is they want to try and identify who the intruder was. And quite often we're able to tell this is a new intruder, this is someone that we haven't seen before, but not necessarily know exactly who it is. So what happens is you end up with different groups, not just within industry, but within government. They will come up with cool-sounding names as to describe this group. And eventually you'll discover, actually what this guy over here thought was, APT-28, this guy over here thinks is Fancy Bear. So you end up with sort of name collisions. And, that will happen across government as well. I'm sure the CIA has a different cover name for this group, and the NSA has a different name as well. And eventually you end up with these cool sounding names that describe this group. But this particular group, we've been tracking them for a very long time. We know that they were involved in, for instance, the hack of the Bundestag. We're reasonably confident that they were also behind the attacks on the Ukrainian power grid and the Ukrainian elections. A couple of years ago, they were also responsible for the hack of a French TV station, TV5 Monde. They're very, very prolific. We find them continuously on, defense company infrastructure. We find them going after banks. We find them going after technology companies. The overwhelming majority of those breaches are never made public, but this is a really prolific group. The body of evidence that sort of backs it up is astronomic, much more than for most other groups. It's one of the best known groups in this space.
When you say a group prolific, we've been tracking them for a long time, what do we know about APT-28? Is it like, it's all right, it's not a guy, 400-pound guy on a bed. Is it 10 400-pound guys on a bed? Is it 50 people? Is it an office building with a, an advanced persistent threat 28 sign on the front? Like, how much do we know about who they are, and where they are and what they're doing? I mean, other than what we can see, in these, after action forensics.
All right, so the public evidence is we know that they're Russian military intelligence, the GRU, where we know where that team is physically based. It's based at the GRU headquarters, sort of colloquially known as the Aquarium. It's a group. It's not enormous. The number of operators is much larger than the number of people who are working in it technically. Clearly, there's not a ton of public evidence about, who it is precisely that's working at GRU. They do outsource, you know, research. They buy in 0 days, for instance, and APT 28 has used 0 days to hack people in the past. They've done a lot of work on spear phishing in particular. They're happy to exploit people's browsers. They're happy to exploit attachments that they send to people. Sometimes they use very sophisticated attacks. Sometimes they use deliberately low-end attacks in order to have sort of operations that it doesn't matter if they get burned. But I mean, there is an enormous amount of information about this, you know, particular group.
Look, I think it's fair to say it's probably akin to what the Russians might know about NSA, right? There's lots and lots of public knowledge. There's lots and lots of espionage operations. You know, there's some core of technical actors and then a very large infrastructure support. And then the actual individual people might change over time as people change roles.
So we should think about this as a significant ongoing intelligence group in the cyber domain that we can reliably attribute the DNC and Podesta hacks to.
Yes, yeah, so we have to attribute them separately because they're not directly connected. And we're able to attribute the Podesta hack to a very sizable portion of the spear phishing hacks that were done by Russian intelligence over that period. So either, you know, Russian intelligence is doing it themselves or they've outsourced that entire program wholesale, which seems quite unlikely. And again, with the DNC hack, this is they're reusing operational infrastructure that they're using for attacking governments. It's sort of strains credulity to suggest that this is being outsourced, although they do outsource other operations.
All right, so this brings us to the president-elect, who presumably has access not merely to everything that CrowdStrike has made public, and that, Matt, that you've just summarized, but also to the categories of material, Susan, that you just hypothesized would make up the confidence of the attribution and IC statements. And yet he is repeatedly casting doubt on the attribution, to the point that the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing yesterday really spent most of its time, both members and witnesses alike, rebutting and expressing confidence in the intelligence community. So what's the range of possibility in both of your view, Susan, you first, about why the president-elect would be so skeptical? Is there any rational basis for the skepticism, or should we look to you know, something more deeply psychological or nefarious in the explanation?
So look, I think the most benign explanation, which is not itself benign, but sort of in the range of what's plausible here, is that Donald Trump appears to form very strong beliefs based on relatively limited amounts of information that he then carries for a very long time. So we hear him referencing over and over again the 2003 intelligence failures related to weapons of mass destruction. So the benign explanation is he is aware of one very significant and consequential intelligence failure. And so he has formed the belief that the intelligence community gets things wrong all the time. It's usually wrong. And you should always treat these sort of assessments with lots of skepticism. Now, most rational adults, when presented with the weight of evidence here, are able to shift their views and understand that's not an accurate description of the current state of affairs. But I think that's kind of the most benign explanation, right? He has these entrenched views. He's incredibly stubborn. This is an inconvenient political talking point, and so he's just going to stay where he is. I think the more likely sort of explanations are more troubling, if not actually nefarious. So one, in my view, this seems like when Donald Trump accuses the intelligence community of being politicized, Federalist. That strikes me as a preemptive strike to undermine the credibility of the report, right? So he is actually, in a sense, politicizing the intelligence community by saying, by talking about them in these terms, by talking about intelligence as though it's a partisan talking point. The reasons for doing that might be because this is uncomfortable, right? He thinks that it sort of casts a pall over his inauguration and his election. Of course, no one has suggested, and no one is suggesting, that the Russians actually hacked voting machines, right? That, he actually was elected president of the United States. He will be inaugurated. But this calls into question the general legitimacy of that election. It's certainly he wants to be talking about other things. Sort of a preemptive strike to undercut the intelligence assessment that's unfriendly to him. That's incredibly short-sighted. He's going to need to rely on the intelligence community in the future. And so sort of taking a shot at their credibility now strikes me as a little bit foolish. It's also important to understand that when Donald Trump says the intelligence community is quote-unquote politicized, that's another way of saying the intelligence community is lying. They do not actually believe what they are saying. Whenever they say this is the weight of evidence, this is what we believe as a clear-eyed assessment, so that sort of as the midpoint, and then I think sort of in the outer reaches of what this the explanation for this might be, it's that Donald Trump doesn't want Russian hacking investigated. He's interested in having a closer relationship with Russia moving forward. He's clearly not bothered by the notion of Russian interference in our elections. He doesn't want to be held accountable by Congress and forced to impose additional sanctions. Potentially, he wants to lift those sanctions that the Obama administration recently imposed. And so really what he's looking to do is, undermine the credibility of the intelligence community because he's going to act against the interests of the United States moving forward. And this is sort of an effort to eliminate opponents from the outset.
What do you think, Matt? How does it look from London in terms of what's motivating Donald Trump here?
So I get the feeling that a lot of this is motivated by a feeling that the claim that Russia hacked the DNC is being used somehow to try and delegitimize his election. And so he feels that this is a personal attack, and therefore the people that are suggesting this must be siding with his opponents. And, there is perhaps some people in the media that are trying to portray the intelligence assessment in that sort of light. It strains credulity to suggest that that's what the intelligence community is trying to do here. I kind of get the feeling that this is really about, I don't like the conclusion because the conclusion is politically damaging to me, and so I'm going to go after the people that are coming to these conclusions because for them to have come to these conclusions, there must have been a political nexus to it, which sort of strikes me as confused thinking in sort of the most positive way that I can phrase it. I do find it particularly troubling that so much of his statements on this have been before his briefing. You know, several of his tweets have been over the past few days, and for him to be saying, you know, I don't believe the intelligence community assessment, or, you know, how is it possible that people know that this is Russia, you know, really going for the jugular against the intelligence community before he's had his briefing as to why the intelligence community think that, I do think that is something that is particularly troubling.
So I want to zero base the question of whether Russia's conduct here is really that outrageous and whether we should really be as offended by it as we all seem to be. What Russia did was not to, you know, interfere in the election in the sense of corrupting any vote counting or committing any vote fraud. What it did is something very much akin to journalism, which is to say it obtained, admittedly by illegal means under U.S. law, information of public interest, and it selectively released that information according to its own sense of its, you might call it news judgment or propaganda judgment. And if the New York Times had done exactly the same thing, probably not by stealing the material, but by, say, getting it leaked by somebody who had stolen it, call him Edward Snowden, we wouldn't call it interfering in the election. We would call it leaks or journalism. And so my question is, why should we be especially troubled by the fact that Hillary Clinton may or may not have paid a price for the substantive content of DNC and John Podesta emails? And why shouldn't we just regard it as part of a longer trend of it's hard to keep information secret, and we generally regard that as a good thing?
So I think there are two sort of primary distinctions or points to be made. The first is that this is not Russia acting like the New York Times, right? The New York Times is the New York Times, and they say we, the New York Times, are publishing this information. Russia is undertaking covert means, right? So it would be one thing if the Russian government was saying, this is our government's position, or even this is our, you know, loosely linked sort of Russian commerce, Chamber of Commerce's views on the election. Right, that allows people to receive information, propaganda information, correcting for the bias, which occurs all the time. Right, we don't prevent foreign countries from offering their opinions on elections, and sometimes actually they are right. It was one of Hillary Clinton's talking points, was saying, look how comfortable our allies are with me versus this, you know, this mentally unhinged person. So the mere fact of sort of the covert active interference that crosses the a line into something that's probably problematic. The second point is sort of, and this is kind of, it's emerged largely from the left, or sort of a wing of the left that can't help but criticize the CIA, and that's saying, the CIA has interfered in elections in the past, and how can we possibly, you know, we do this all the time. Whether or not that's accurate or not, who cares? This is not, yes, it would be very silly for the United States to stand up and have great moral outrage at how dare Vladimir Putin even think about doing this to us, and sort of have our feelings hurt about it. That would be kind of silly. I would suggest it would be akin to, I don't know, the German government acting incredibly shocked that there would be signals intercepts against them when their own government engages in the same, or their own intelligence services engages in the same, right? There's sort of a hypocrisy to that. Just because we do it to other people, or we've done it to other people, doesn't mean that we have to accept it being done to us. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't respond. It just means that we forfeit the ability to be credibly morally outraged.
What do you think, Matt? Is it, should we just understand Putin as a journalist here?
A hack and the distribution of the documents are different, and we should be differently outraged by them. And actually, you know, it's pretty clear when you sort of look through the history of what actually happened that people were differently outraged. You know, when CrowdStrike came out and said, you know, we found, you know, some malware on the DNC network, you know, lots of people, myself included, said, you know, so what, right? You know, Russian intelligence is hacking the, you know, then likely winner of the next presidency. Big deal. I mean, that's what they're for. In the event that Russia wasn't hacking the DNC, they should ask for their tax rubles back. That's what they literally pay their intelligence services for. And it really started to become different when, you know, these emails were being leaked. And they were being leaked in a way that I think was, you know, quite different to merely the content of them being sort of the focus. And actually, you know, we have some really good data on that, because as it happens, a lot of Hillary Clinton's emails were in the public domain, being continuously released under the Freedom of Information Act long before the you know, Russian intelligence got involved. And, you know, lots of people were outraged at, you know, some of the things that were in there, and there was lots of stories that came out from that. But it really did sort of take a much darker turn once you had, you know, the Guccifer IIs and the WikiLeaks getting involved and really sort of drumming up fictitious outrage, taking emails completely out of context. So to give you an example just from the other day, where Julian Assange goes on Fox News and says, John Podesta's password is password. And actually, if you look in the emails, that's really not what it says. So I think there is a difference between, you know, the sort of the release of the content versus the method by which they released, and the method being the thing that we're really objecting to, this sort of interference in a way that is decoupled from the content.
Okay, so one thing that has happened in the last week or two is that the president, the current president, has released a series of sanctions and a series of punitive steps Lindsey Graham yesterday at the hearing said he was ready to throw a rock. Barack Obama had thrown a pebble, and he wanted to do a whole lot more in response to this. Number one, did Barack Obama throw a rock or a pebble? And number two, what does throwing a rock here look like? If we take as a given that we want to make a strong statement here and that Trump is wrong, was this it? And if not, what would it look like?
So, look, this was certainly sort of the combination of responses between expelling diplomats, imposing sanctions, banning travel, seizing these compounds in the United States. It's the strongest response we've had. It's more like a pebble than a rock, because the relative unit of measurement here is not what we've thrown in the past. It's whether or not it is actually effective in deterring this conduct going forward. So the way to ask what should the response look like, you have to think about, okay, what is a response that is going to get Vladimir Putin or other countries that might engage in this behavior in the future to think twice, to say, you know what, maybe I won't attempt to interfere with the American election, considering the sort of monumental payoff, right? Whether or not there was the direct motivation for hacking or not, clearly Putin preferred Trump to Hillary Clinton. Clearly he prefers Trump to Barack Obama. He favors this warming relationship between the United States and Russia moving forward. So how are we going to impose costs that eliminate the payoff here? There's a couple of features to it. One is, ordinarily, you would have a president-elect that was sensitive to political pressure here, right? And would be interested in, even if he didn't believe that the Russians were involved, would be interested in distancing himself, right? Sort of proving to the American people, hey, maybe Russia was involved, maybe they weren't, but I have nothing to do with that. And I'm not Putin's man. I'm not the puppet. You're a puppet.
No puppet.
Going back to the debate exchanges. Instead, actually, we've seen Trump really sort of defiant about this and defiant of his own party. And so that means that we are likely to see nothing out of the executive branch in terms of consequences for Putin. As of January 1st, that leaves the period between now and January 20th. That leaves the period between now and the 20th for Barack Obama to take action. And then, of course, Congress. If I was a member of Congress, one way I would ensure Vladimir Putin never did this again was I would reject every single nominee that was viewed as even remotely favorable to Russian interests. I would not accept Rex Tillerson, whether or not I thought he would be a reasonable Secretary of State or not. The mere optics. I would not confirm anybody who had an anti-sanctions position. I would commit to imposing additional sanctions moving forward, and I would make clear to President Trump that for every sanction he removes at the executive level, Congress will impose a sanction at the legislative level. Additionally, I think Barack Obama sort of hinted or suggested that we had not seen the sum total of responses. That there would be either a covert or non-public response back. We would need to see very, very strong signaling. So I think an appropriate response would be either a response in cyberspace. I know Matt doesn't necessarily agree with that being the right domain, but I think if we are going to respond in cyberspace, it should signal capacity, right? So it should show Putin we can do do something to harm you that you didn't think we could do. And it should also signal reach. We can see into, we have insight into your structure or your finances or areas that you thought were private and protected. So don't mess with us moving forward. I really do think it's going to be up to Republican senators like Lindsey Graham, John McCain, Ben Sasse, other people that have really taken on the mantle to ensure we have an appropriate response moving forward, because we're not going to see it from Donald Trump.
Matt, pebble or rock?
It felt a bit like a shotgun, I think, but from a distance. So, you know, some things landed and some things really didn't. And when you sort of look at the range of sanctions, I think the strength of them combined was pretty sensible sort of level of strength. The problem was that it was sort of so spread over and it sort of mixed so many different things together that it didn't really land necessarily very well. So, for instance, the State Department put out as part of their statement, you know, these 35 diplomats that we're sending home, this is partly also because of Russian harassment of our diplomats. So you end up with people slightly confused as to, you know, are we sending back the 35 Russian spies, you know, Russian diplomats, are we sending them back because you hacked our election, or are we sending them back because you harassed our diplomats? And, you know, are we sending them back because actually we're really upset at you hacking the DNC, or because you were interfering in the election? And when you look at, for instance, you know, the organizations that were sanctioned, we have, you know, GRU was sanctioned, but then so was FSB. And, you know, when we look at the malware on the DNC network, there was APT-29, which was the FSB, and APT-28, which was GRU. But it was GRU that did the distribution, the theft of documents and the passing them around. That wasn't what FSB did. So including FSB there, I think, sends slightly mixed messages. And also when we look at things like the joint FBI-DHS report, I don't think it was clear enough to people that this report wasn't attempting to lay the groundwork as to the US's attribution position. This was not a document saying this is why we think it's Russia. This was a document to say, hey, if you're a small cybersecurity firm or a cybersecurity researcher, you know, here are some things that you can look for on your networks in order to be a bit more protected. And I think they sort of mashed that document a little bit in a way that made it, you know, not very clear, and it sort of led to a lot of people getting sort of mixed messages and confused. And you know, a couple of days after the sanctions, people weren't saying, wow, this sanction package has caused a lot of harm to Russia. They were sort of scratching their heads and wondering what exactly had happened, and, you know, what were we punishing, and how were we punishing it, and were we really punishing it very strongly? And it just felt a little bit confused.
So we are going to have a report that is being briefed to Trump today, I think was briefed to Obama yesterday. And some version of which is going to be made public next week, at which the Intel Committee, Senate Intel Committee, is having a hearing again. Let's finish up with what we should expect from that. Matt, what are you looking for in the next few days?
So I think it's going to give us two things. So first of all, I think on this particular thing, that there's a really strong public case that Russia hacked the DNC and hacked John Podesta, and that it was sort of running that operation. There's not that much that we can deduce just from sheer public information as to why they were doing that. What was their purpose? You know, how did this operation play out? Did it start differently to how it ended? At what point was President Putin involved, or you know, how far down did it go? And so I think that the report will go through that to a certain extent. The other thing that I think that is quite interesting and quite noteworthy about this report is that it's not billed as a Russian hacking report. It's billed as a foreign interference in US presidential elections report from 2008 to present. So this is the last three presidential elections and not merely limited to Russia. So what I really hope they're going to include is they're going to include what other countries were doing so that you can have a baseline. You can say, hang on a minute, you know, when other countries, you know, hack people that are standing for president, that was different. And how was it different? So that we can actually make the case that actually what happened in 2016 wasn't just an intelligence agency acting as per usual, that there was something qualitatively and quantitatively different about it.
Susan, what's one thing you're looking forward to in the next few days?
So I hope that the I think the report has a very, very specific goal to accomplish, and it actually is different than I think what Matt's describing would be incredibly useful and helpful if the purpose of the report was to justify the U.S. response either domestically or to the international community. Typically, that's what a report like this would be designed to do. In this very, very strange political moment with this very, very strange president-elect, I think this report has a very narrow goal that it must achieve, and that is that it has to eliminate the realm, it has to eliminate plausible deniability for Donald Trump. Donald Trump has demonstrated that if there is any wiggle room whatsoever, any ability for him to, with a straight face, say that he doesn't believe that there were Russian, there was Russian involvement in election interference, he will take that opportunity, and he will attempt to use it as a political to drive a political wedge. So I really think that this this report needs to be specific. I think it needs to not be risk averse. It needs to embrace some level of risk to sources and methods in terms of revealing specificity. And I really think it needs to eliminate Donald Trump's ability to, with a straight face, say, I don't believe the Russians were involved, or this is a political witch hunt. And it really needs to arm Congress with the evidence and public evidence that it can then use to explain to its constituents, hey, look, this is not about us opposing Donald Trump. This is about preserving the existence of free and fair elections in the United States moving forward. This is why we are undertaking this action, and this is why we think it's unacceptable that the president-elect is not standing behind his intelligence community.
We are going to leave it there. Susan Hennessy, Matt Tate, thanks for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with, let me think about that. Oh, yeah, the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Matt for beaming himself in from London to join us on short notice. We need to do more to promote the Lawfare Podcast. You need to be tweeting about the Lawfare Podcast, sharing it on Facebook. You need to review the Lawfare Podcast. You need to talk endlessly to your friends and neighbors and make a nuisance of yourself by talking about the Lawfare Podcast. Our music is performed by the elusive Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.